You're listening to a thoroughly good podcast made for the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, celebrating women who serve, a podcast series that spotlights, celebrates and honours the pioneering women who have served and are serving in the Army. My name is John Jacob. I'm a writer and a podcaster. I normally focus my energies on classical music. That's my comfort area, speaking to musicians about the work they do and the music they love. But when the Women's Royal Army Corps Association approached me to make this series, something piqued my interest. I know very little about the Army. I know even less about the women who serve in the Army too. Some would say that lack of knowledge is a handicap. If you're going to speak to a group of Army veterans, you need to know what they do. The reality is something quite different. Without first-hand knowledge or experience, curiosity reigns. And that, combined with the stories that Army veterans have to share, makes, potentially, for an illuminating series of interviews. In 2018, the British Army announced that all roles within the Army would be open to women. It marked a significant milestone in a journey towards equality in the armed services that spans over a century. For those of us who have been blessed with not having to fight for equal opportunity, that journey would be all too easy to overlook. That's the reasoning behind this series, the impetus, to gain a deeper understanding of what women have done in the Army in the past, to help make it possible for the women of the present to play the role they do. You'll hear from women now in their 80s and 90s and centenarians, and some of their families too, as they recall the decisions they made and the actions they took before, during and after the Second World War. They are enlivening exchanges, enriching, highly prized. But first, we should start somewhere closer to the present day, because before we can appreciate where women started from, we need to get a sense of where they are now. To that end, I spoke to Ali Brown, Vice President of the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, and we started with an assumption of mine about service, the kind of service that has played a central part in Ali's Army career. Where did you end up serving?
I served all over the world. I spent my first few years in Germany, because it was a Cold War. But then when that started to break down, I went to the first Gulf War, so Iraq and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And I did Kosovo, I did Bosnia, I did America, I went to Finland, I went to Africa. I mean, literally all over the world.
When I hear, this is my perspective really, but when I hear people talking about where they served and war, there's a dissonance for me. There's something that I can't really settle on, which is I hear those words and I experience fear, and then that makes me go, well, because I experience fear or because I assume fear, I sort of don't. This will sound slightly disrespectful. I sort of don't understand why anybody would want to put themselves in that position.
In all the experiences I had, and the worst tour, the worst operational tour was Kosovo. That was the most brutal. That was the most horrific. The first Gulf War was very much armoured warfare. So I was in an armoured vehicle for 7 months, and I was safe. I think Kosovo was the tour where I wasn't safe. But I don't remember fear. I remember excitement, which sounds awful, but that's what it was. An opportunity to do my job, which I trained for. And, of course, I had a huge team around me. And I think that's one of the benefits of being an officer, because you are commanding men and women, mostly men. So you have a big team around you. You have a big team working for you. And you're never really alone. You might be alone in some of the decisions you have to make, but you're never really physically alone. And I think that helps a lot with fear. I think that keeps fear at bay. I think what you feel when you come back home, that's probably the closest I've got to fear. Some officers I worked with had to leave operational theatres. So I think fear is something which we all experienced, but I kind of saved it until I got home, until I felt that I could, I suppose, indulge myself in feeling it.
What prompted you to sign up to the army initially?
Initially, it was very much my father's influence, I think. My dad wasn't in the army, but he worked with the army. He was a government scientist, so he was involved in developing thermal imagery on main battle tanks. So a lot of the stuff that he did, I used to go along with him at weekends down to Bobbington and watch some of his trials going on the tanks. And I think that kind of influenced me. And I made the decision very young. I remember being about 8 and telling my parents that I was going in the army. Of course, no idea of what the army meant for women in those days. And I didn't look at anything else. I went. My only agreement with my parents, a bargain if you like, was that I would go to university before I went into the army. They were very keen for me to experience university, which I did. And then I joined the army age 21.
I'm wondering what it was that you saw that made you think, I want to go into the army.
I think I was one of 3 girls. I was the middle girl. I was what was called a tomboy, I suppose. They used to call it a tomboy back then, didn't they? I wanted to do the football bit. I just saw that boys seemed to have more fun than girls. I went to a very academic school, and I just thought that the army sounded really exciting. When I spent the days with my dad down at Bobbington at the Tank Museum, you know, it all seemed exciting. I knew that a lot of it went on abroad. And I suppose the careers that were on offer, I mean, I went to school in the 70s and went to university in 1981. And there was still a bit of a society thing that, yes, you could have a career, and lots of things, of course, were open to women. But there was still that underlying, you can have a career until you get married and have children, and then it kind of stops. So I knew I didn't want that. I knew I wanted something which was going to be a full career. And my mum was great at saying to all her daughters, you must have independent money. You know, you must have money that is independent from your husband. And I guess I took that on board and the exciting stuff that the army seemed to do. And that's when I kind of made my mind up. And as I say, I didn't look anywhere else. So I didn't look at any other careers at all. I'm not sure what I would have done if I hadn't got into the army. So I think it was that. I think it was the excitement and not wanting to fall into the norm, I guess.
When I hear you talk about this, I have this idea of that you observed a sense of urgency. I hear urgency in the work that your dad was doing.
Yeah, the work was, again, it was exciting to me because, you know, he used to go to Russia when nobody went to Russia. And he used to spend a lot of time in the States working with scientists and other physicians on this thermal imagery because night sights in tanks were getting very big in those days. They were getting very popular. They were getting very necessary. And this, of course, was during the Cold War. And I just thought that whole thing sounded so exciting and clandestine and just exciting. And I guess I wanted to be a part of that, and the army seemed to offer me that opportunity.
I wonder whether retrospectively you then recognised, or maybe you recognise now, what had gone on before you joined the army that allowed for you to be able to join when you did.
Yeah, I think, again, I have to bring it back to my parents and the choices they made in educating me. Education was very big in my parents' lives. Dad went to Oxford. He was a scholarship boy. He was from a very poor family. And he got this scholarship, which allowed him to be privately educated and then go to Oxford. So I was privately educated. And I think that not only opened my mind to the opportunities, but also gave me the encouragement of the school, because the school was very positive when I said that the army was going to be for me, and very supportive in women, because it's an all-girls school, women stepping out of the norm. And my parents were quite disciplinarian, they were quite strict, but it was education all the way. And I think that gave me the discipline, but also the structure. I went to a boarding school, and I think that structure became part of my comfort blanket, if you like. And I was looking for that sort of structure in life. And I think the army became that structure. After the Second World War, the army very much wanted women to go back where they had been before the Second World War. You know, during the Second World War, women had done jobs which you would never have think of women doing. They were motorbike dispatch riders, they were drivers, they were delivering Spitfires to factories in the Air Force, in the Women's Air Force. But after the war, it kind of stopped, and women were still allowed to join the army, but they were put back into those roles which society thought were more appropriate. By the time I came along to the army in 1984, that was starting to break down, and questions were being asked as to why women couldn't be employed on a wider basis. And from the moment I joined in 84 until about 95, all of the old restrictions, like you couldn't serve if you got pregnant, you couldn't serve in a combat area, you weren't paid equally, your pension wasn't equal, all those kind of restrictions, slowly but surely, it was like dominoes really, they all fell one by one. And by 1993, the army was, they called themselves an equal opportunities employer. They weren't. The culture still had a heck of a long way to go, and some will say that the culture is still quite hard on the minorities. But by policy, by about 95, all of the restrictions on women had gone. So by 95, there was no reason why I couldn't compete equally and have the career that a man could have.
Imagine those people who went before you and the members of WRIC. If you think of them, what do you perceive they see of their the people who followed them? How do they look on the people who followed them? Do you think?
I think that the main feeling that I have heard them express is envy. That they enjoyed their service life. But they didn't have the opportunities that I had. They didn't have the breadth of opportunities promotion-wise, career-wise, and also travel, and also going to on operations, because they weren't allowed to. In 1990 was when the operational rules changed and women were allowed to deploy. In fact, they changed whilst I was in Kuwait. Pre-1990, women weren't having that same operational experience. Although women had been on operations in Northern Ireland for years, but I kind of, that's slightly separate for me. So I think envy is something I have heard expressed, just as in a way, I'm envious now of the young women joining today, because they have 100% of roles open to them. Whereas in my day, it was 73%. That was as good as it got. Women can join the infantry, women can join the Royal Armour Corps. Well, we couldn't have dreamt of doing that. And I think that equality of opportunity is a marvellous thing. I really do. Post-Second World War, the ATS remained until 1949, and then it changed into the Women's Royal Armour Corps. So the MOD accepted that there needed to be a corps of women in the British Army. So that was a good thing. They accepted that they needed to be there. But what they said to them was, yes, we need you, but you can no longer be a motorbike dispatch rider. You're now going to go and be a secretary. So there was a subtle kind of putting them back into what society accepted. And a lot of women, and we found it after the First World War, the women who joined the army in the First World War, they couldn't go back. They couldn't go back to nursing their sick mothers. They couldn't go back to what, you know, they were in before the wars. And that's where, in a way, the WRC Association stepped in as a charity. And a lot of our money after both wars went into helping women to emigrate away from Great Britain and into the new world, if you like, of Australia and New Zealand and Canada. And a lot of our charity's money went into assisting women to do that because they just couldn't. They couldn't go back to what society wanted them to do. And also to be in uniform in the late 40s and early 50s, it wasn't seen as a good thing if you were female. The army was seen as a career of last choice.
That's crushing.
Yeah, absolutely crushing. And I think after the First World War, when, of course, women joined the army for the first time in non-nursing roles, again, after that war, it was even more of a societal division, I suppose, because most of the women, their only choice was to go back into service, and they didn't want to do it. And emigration to Australia and New Zealand was seen as a far better option than going back into service. Society has always led the way in most of the changes over the last sort of 60, 70 years. But I think the army kind of polarised it. The women who were in the army with those experiences behind them, and this is for all generations, I think feel those societal restrictions more deeply, more heavily. I mean, when I was in, one of the jobs I really wanted to do was command a college at Sandhurst, which is the officer's training school. And I really wanted to do that job. And I had all the qualifications to do the job, and I knew I could do it, but I was told I couldn't do it because I was female. And that was in 2003. And yet, in 2015, the first woman commanded the college at Sandhurst. So I think even then, there were those frustrations on the way. But I think you learn to fight through them. You learn to, awful phrase, take it on the chin and carry on.
What do you think those people who went before you and the membership, what do you think, and I suppose I'm referring to those who are in their 80s and 90s and older, What do you think they achieved in the army which made you joining possible?
Women who served in the Second World War, the roles that they did and the positions of danger they put themselves in, because they weren't armed. At least wherever I went, I carried a weapon. I was allowed to carry a weapon. But they weren't. They weren't armed. And they were in France. And they did go over on D-Day plus one. So my career was entirely made possible by the women who served in the ATS first during the Second World War, but also the women who did the hard slog during the 60s and 70s, because they're the women who proved that women could do these jobs. And could be trusted to do these jobs, and could have careers. You know that they before 1987, you couldn't get pregnant and stay in. So all the women who went before that, who had full careers, they had a choice. They either had a full career or they had children, and it was a straightforward choice. You could not do both. So you know those women sacrificed quite a lot in my eyes to have those full careers. But if they hadn't have proven the worth of women, then I wouldn't have been able to have the career that I had. So I think we owe everything to the women that went before us.
Did they sort of express any bitterness about how they were sort of pushed away, or was it sort of very much accepted? And I get the impression that, that people who are in the 80s and 90s who reflect on their army career are extremely self-deprecating and very humble and probably don't really like the attention, and so probably don't express that kind of thing. But I just wonder whether there was an element of, oh, we've done this, and actually, is that all?
I'm sure there was. I'm sure there was at the time. But it's interesting, as you say, they don't talk about it like that. They sort of say, well, you know, we did our job, and then I had to go back home and sit and nurse my sick mother. But there's a level of, I guess when you get to 90, there's this level of acceptance that is how it was. And I find myself starting to have that level of acceptance that is how it was. But they are, those ladies from that era are so humble, and a lot of them didn't really understand just how out there they were. And I think it's only when we tell their stories like we're doing, and we bring them into the open, that actually they think, oh yeah, we really did do something quite special. And I don't think we've done enough of that. I think celebration of women in the army and what women have achieved in the army, we haven't done enough of it at all.
What do you, this is going to sound a little odd, but what do you feel when you meet one of them?
Oh, I feel all sorts of emotions. I feel so proud of them. I feel almost tearful, which is, and it's not sad tears, but it's pride. I am so proud of what women managed to do despite the constraints, despite all the criticism. And they really are the most marvellous generation of women. And we are so lucky to have, you know, so many of them left who can tell their stories. And some of them went through the most horrendous experiences, and yet that they can still put a smile on their face and say, you know, I did that.
You've been listening to Women Who Serve, a podcast series that spotlights, celebrates and honours the pioneering women who have served and are serving in the army. It was a thoroughly good production for the Women's Royal Army Corps Association.